It is 4:45. This is Downtown Tuesday afternoon. It's time for Message in the Bottle, brought to you by Bangor Wine and Cheese Company at 86 Hammond Street in downtown Bangor, right between Brahma Grill and Fiddlehead Restaurant. Eric Meehan joining us here in studio. Good day, sir.
Hello again, everybody. How's everybody doing? I know everybody was like, what is that creaky, awful-sounding voice in the last segment? Like, no, it's me.
No, it's...
I'm here early.
It's you and your bass baritone wonderfulness that... I don't know if we told you this. Did I tell you this? Carrie was talking about how your voice plays out visually on our editing computer.
He must hate. I'm sure it spikes all over the place. Thank God for...
Oh, no, 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 no.
And everything.
No, what it is there's a midline, and your voice is noticed. Most voices are noticeably sort of half and half.
Huh.
But yours is noticeably much lower
If you folks would be here in the studio, you could actually see there's a golden glow emanating from the computer screen. It's magnificent.
And it prints out, I guess it's just an automated thing, but it appears on the screen. It says, man and a half.
Wow. Christine, I hope you're listening. I know you don't believe it, but it's official. Computers approved it.
By the way, Christine, I was rude. I did not wave to you when I saw you out walking today, but only because I'm old and the glasses don't always work. And I didn't realize it was you until I had driven by.
I guarantee my wife was in such a zone. It sounds like they were right straight. Apparently my wife got to clean up. Somebody put half of a banana in their back pocket, laid down on an examination table at one of her other, 15 places of employment, which is my father-in-law's plastic surgery office, and forgot it was there and smushed it all over. And my wife got to clean it up.
Oh.
So tonight for dinner, we're not going home. We're going and having pizza up at our friends Bear Brew in Orono and listening to my father-in-law's band play. And by the way, if anybody likes good big band music, it's happening on the Orono Waterfront Park, whatever it is. I've never actually been there, but it sounds like everybody else knows where it is. So listen for the good swinging music and come check out that at 6:30 to 7:30 tonight.
Very cool.
Anyway, so we're talking wine because that's what we do here, and we're in the Iberian Peninsula this week. And I've been doing a lot of reading today, and it's absolutely fascinating because I've never really understood the political ramifications of basically everything that rippled through the Iberian Peninsula in this past century. I guess it kind of goes without saying that most of Europe has been under threat of war and constant war for a very, very long time. Anybody who studied European history and indeed mankind's history knows that that's kind of what we do. But very interesting things happened in the Iberian Peninsula politically that really have benefited us in kind of an odd way now that we're kind of past it and into the new world order. And the wine that we're going to be drinking today is sort of a result of that beneficence. So we're going to talk the original and title of this segment last year. I called it the Tempranillo Belt and the Frenchianization of Spain. And really what this has to do with, like everything in wine has to do with, is when vines die and you made your living on the vine, people move, right? So the phylloxera laus invaded Europe in the mid-1800s, courtesy of botanical clippings that were going back from North America. Again, sorry, Europe, but I figure no one's still alive from that time, so you're all over it at this point. And it killed 99% of the vineyards, and there was mass exodus of a lot of wine-heavy regions to places where they could, folks could make a living doing anything else, really. And so what happened to Spain was that a lot of French winemakers, especially from the Bordeaux region and the southwest of France, made their way down through the Basque region. And again, reminding you, like we talked about last week, that the Pyrenees are this huge border between Spain and France. And so the only way around them is basically on either extremity of them, and that being near Barcelona and along the southern edge of France, or indeed in that little crook between France and Spain on the Atlantic. And so that's where a lot of the Bordelais came through Saint-Sébastien and down. And they brought with them clippings, and they also brought with them the knowledge of barrel aging of wines, which influenced heavily, especially the places that they came originally, which is the Navarra region and the Rioja region. And of course, I'm sure Rioja resounds with many of you. That's probably the most famous region we'll be talking about today. But that's where they really brought a lot of these ideas of blending different grapes, barrel aging different grapes, and it really influenced that part of the world a great deal. And the grape that was really harnessed and started to get used more and more heavily because it also grew very well in Spain was the Tempranillo grape, or the Tempranilla, if you want to be gauche about it. Tempranillo is a very, Tempranillo means sort of little cranky one. It's a very kind of tricky grape, but it happens to have a fairly quick ripening season. And so Spain actually is very, very elevated as a country. It is the second highest in terms of elevation country in Europe. And so the ripening seasons is not as long as you'd think for sort of that southern Mediterranean kind of vibe that you think we all think Spain has. So the Tempranillo kind of caught on because it could grow very fast. And so the French and the Spanish winemakers really started to use it more and more and rip up a lot of the native varietals in favor of this. And so the Tempranillo belt that I'm kind of talking about, it really started in that area of Navarra, Rioja. And if you kind of imagine Spain as sort of a torso, I was sort of saying it as a belt, but imagine it more as a sash, right? Like coming down from Navarra, Rioja, and then crossing the torso into places like Ribera del Duero, Toro, and then crossing the Portuguese border into the Douro Valley, which of course is most famous for supplying the grapes that go into port wine. The Douro Valley also, incidentally, is the oldest officially delimited zone in the world, going back into the mid-1700s. So Tempranillo really started to take hold. But where does the political history aspect of this conversation today kind of come in? Well, what happened is there was a Portuguese revolution. So there was a monarchy in Portugal, and then in 1910 there was a revolution there, and they tried to set up a democratic republic. It wasn't super democratic, and it wasn't super successful. And so there was another revolution in 1939, and a group called the period known as the Estado Novo, which is a far right capitalist oriented society. It was anti-communist, it was anti-socialist, it was anti-liberal, took over and really stressed, you know, corporatism and sort of a nationalism strength. At the same time, in Spain, you had the Franco dictatorship, and they didn't so much get along, even though covertly there was arms supplied between the two of them, because arms surpass politics. I mean, if you can sell guns, you're going to sell guns. But basically, there was no friendship there. So there was sort of this lock between Portugal and Spain. And in addition, what you had during that time, of course, was World War I. And then after 1939, you had World War II. So there was just this huge period of not only tumult, but isolationism and various factions vying for this and that. And what suffered, I guess, or what got forgotten, was basic elements of humanity, like enjoying wine and agriculture and things like that. Agriculture became part of the machine. And of course, after World War II, it had to be part of the machine just to recover. So that makes sense. But what happened is a lot of the great things got forgotten. So that leads me to the great wine that we're having today, Achados e Perdidos, Lost and Found. This is a wine imported by a good friend of mine, Chris Campbell, who I have known as long as I have cared about good wine, which is great because he is perhaps the most passionate person I've ever met, not only about wine, but just about why most of us are into wine, which is sitting down at table and laughing and eating good food and drinking good wine and forgetting all about the fact that the world can be rough. And he's a very, very passionate man. He got his start working for Mario Batali, actually, interesting wow. enough, in a Spanish-themed restaurant, not what Batali is known for, but he did have one, Bar Jamal, in Manhattan, and he started trying to sell Spanish wines, and then he realized that there was no good Spanish wines, and so he went and started importing them, and then he got into these Portuguese wines. Now, this particular wine is fantastic. It's what a great story. So there are these two guys in Portugal, really, really well-respected winemakers, young, going around and trying to make something out of the native varietals, the lost varietals, the things that really should be making Portugal special. Port is great. I mean, port, everybody likes port, blah, 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 blah. Not the point. Vino Verde is great, blah, 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 blah. Although they make a fantastic Vino Verde because it's a serious Vino Verde. It's not just, you know, fizzy juice. And that was one of their goals as well. But they, this happened, they were drinking wine with a friend. They were drinking their grandfather's house wine. It was a, made for the family. It wasn't even sold or anything. And they said, well, it's really good. And their friend said, well, this is a field blend. It's we don't even really know what's in it. It's just from my grandfather's plot. You know, it was heavily farmed. It's one of these beautiful terraced vineyards in the Douro Valley. And by the way, if you've never been to the Douro Valley, and I haven't either, but I want to get there because it is a protected UNESCO site. It is absolutely gorgeous. It dates from the times of the Romans. And again, there are these terraced hillsides. And he said, yeah, there's all these grapes there. We don't know what it is, but he makes this wine and it's really good. So they went and they made a contract with his grandfather and they did a lot of research. There are 29 different native varietals in this vineyard. One of them is white, and they bottle that separately, and apparently it is amazing. But I've never gotten my hands on it because one person bought all of it in the first vintage, so I hope to try that again soon, or for the first time soon. But this one is really cool. This is all the other 28 uvas, and it has in it Tempranillo, because that, of course, is our topic today. And then it has just everything else. And so this, I think, is a really good indication of what was happening before all that political nonsense, before all the tumult. And I know I'm running out of time as we enjoy this, so I did want to mention next Thursday, the 28th, we have the tasting, monthly tasting. We'll be featuring this wine, other great Iberian wines, and also our friends from Rocky Ground Cider in Newburgh. And if you are a fan of real cider, folks, not, you know, these fizzy, silly stuff, woodchucky stuff. And I mean, if you like that, that's cool too. But like, if you want like real interesting barrel-aged ciders, do come out, do meet these people. They're hyper passionate and I love it. But yeah, so Achados e Perdidos, Lost and Found. Really cool. Come try it. It is our wine of the week. So it's 10% off this week.
This is special. This is fantastic. Thank you, Chris.
And construction update. Hopefully by the end of the month, we'll be done.
Very good. Thank you, Eric. Eric Meehan, Bangor Wine and Cheese, 86 Hammond Street in downtown Bangor. Message in the bottle every Tuesday.